Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Once again, it's a pleasure to be able to share a positive hour of empowering insights into the human condition. I'm talking on the telephone today because of some technical issues, because I'm on location. Hopefully on our next program, back in the studio, and everything will be back to normal. But I'm sure you can hear me all right. We begin with the latest on health and healing. A study from the University of California at Irvine shows that a nutrient you may not have heard of is called N-acetylglucosamine. And here's the good news. It restores neurological function in multiple sclerosis patients. And that's terrific. It's a sugar molecule, and it reduces multiple inflammation and neurodegenerative markers in people who suffer from multiple sclerosis. In addition, they also found this dietary supplement, it's natural and non-toxic, improved neurological function in 30% of patients. So that's a big deal. I've worked with people with multiple sclerosis for a long time. In fact, I have a person, his name is Kenny. He's been on the show at least a dozen times. Full-blown multiple sclerosis, end stage, two sets of neurologists explaining how he had to have his home refurnished with these metal bars that he could walk around without falling, and even on his bed to put to the bed so he had these barriers so he wouldn't fall out. And he came to a class about 12 years ago, and it was a class I was starting on helping people with brain conditions with lifestyle and behavior modification, no medicines. But it was supervised by Dr. Martin Feldman, a board-certified leading nationally respected neurologist. And at the end of 16 months, it wasn't overnight, not only did he completely reverse his condition, but people with multiple sclerosis and myasthenia gravis and Parkinson's, all these conditions had either major improvements or complete reversal. So something that I've known, and many of us have been using N-acetylglucosamine, but it hasn't been made public because there haven't been the studies. Now there is. So this is really exciting. And so anyone in the audience who has a relative who has Parkinson's disease and also multiple sclerosis, I would recommend it that be considered for both. And a major issue with current therapies with multiple sclerosis is the inability to treat chronic active neuroinflammation in the brain and the associated failure to repair the loss of myelin sheath that covers and protects axons, the electrical wires of the brain. And over time, this leads to permanent nerve cell damage and slow progressive loss of neurological function in patients. And this helps stop that. So we want to thank MD, PhD, and Professor of Neurology and Microbiology and Molecular Genetics at the University, Dr. Michael Demetrio, for his outstanding research. Now, from the Linus Pauling Institute, diminished levels of vitamin K, not high levels of vitamin E, could be the key factor in prostate cancer links. And the heavily criticized research linking vitamin E and cancer has damaged the sector. But this professor at the Linus Pauling Institute told a symposium a study into vitamin K and vitamin E levels and interactions was shedding light on the issue. Here's what he said. He said, there has been a huge vitamin E backlash due to study links to cancer and more. Those adverse effects have nothing to do with vitamin E and everything to do with deficiencies of vitamin K. So this is something brand new. So for all those people who say, well, you can't take vitamin E, it can cause cancer, there is absolutely zero proof of that. It's just the opposite. But it was a deficiency in vitamin K that was causing the problems. So make sure you're getting your vitamin K. And by the way, vitamin K is huge in the brain, but nobody was researching it. And so make sure you get your vitamin K and your vitamin E in adequate amounts every day. Now, from the University of Exeter, women receiving inflated risks from genetic testing could undergo unnecessary breast cancer surgery. This is a little complicated. Let's simplify it. After being told that they are at a high risk from genetic test results that do not take family history into account, do not take lifestyle into account, do not take depression, anxiety, stress, smoking, drinking, nutrient deficiencies, malnutrition, obesity. None of those risk factors are they really considering. But if you test positive the BRCA gene 1 or 2, then you're going to be told, oh, you have a 60-80% risk of breast cancer. Okay, in fact, the risk could be less than 20% if they do not have a close relative with the condition and not considering any of the things you can do. Now, remember when Angelina Jolie and other celebrities started to remove completely healthy breasts? Well, there was no cancer at all. But this damn BRCA gene that they all weighed on, that's caused, in my opinion, the abuse of women at a medical level, because we can now show unequivocally and absolutely that when you change your lifestyle to a healthy lifestyle, you can then intercede in genetic expression and not have disease. And yet, the same group of people, narrow-minded and very rigid, say, no, you know, if you have the gene, then you should get breast cancer. This is published in eClinical Medicine. And so I'm opposed to this. I'm opposed to using only a genetic marker to determine a medical intervention. You must take into account lifestyle. And they're not, and that's unfortunate. From the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai and the University of California, San Francisco, and Harvard Medical School, systems biology research study reveals benefits of vacation and meditation. Do you really need a Harvard study to tell you that vacation and meditation are good for you? I don't think so. This is kind of, this is rhetorical science. But what they found, they used a rigorous study designed to assess the biological impact of meditation compared to vacation. And they examined the effect of meditation on gene expression patterns in both novice and regular meditators. And the researchers found that a resort vacation provides a strong and immediate impact on molecular networks associated with stress and immune pathways, in addition to short-term improvements in well-being, as measured by feelings of vitality and distress. A meditation retreat for those who already use meditation regularly was associated with a molecular network characterized by antiviral activity, built the immune system. That's great. The molecular signature of long-term meditators was distinct from the non-meditating vacationers. And here's why. I have people right now enjoying a wonderful retreat as a fundraiser we're doing. And this is just one of the nicest group of people I've ever met. And they are having a great time. There's laughter nonstop. I put a lot of laughter and humor into my lectures. They're exercising vigorously there. And I ask, tell me the worst problem you've ever had in your life and see if I can help give a different way of looking at it and helping resolve it. And thus far, it's been very successful, 5 out of 5. But I'm doing this with each person in front of everyone so they can see how sometimes the solution to our problems are right in front of us. Some are just self-evident. Remember what I've said for a long time. Never confuse the complexity of a problem with the simplicity of its solution. But we want to make our solutions as complicated and convoluted as our problem. And that's where we get into a dilemma. And then we have all these so-called experts. Well, when you're on a vacation, you're away from a lot of the daily stressors and responsibilities and routines and rituals. That's going to lower your blood pressure. That's going to create more when you go swimming in the ocean or scuba diving or riding a horse on the sand, whatever it is. You're going to have dopamine hits. You're going to feel good. And you're going to come back, and all of that will release stress temporarily. And that's the key. It's not sustainable. Then, if you meditate, you enhance your immune system. You produce more of the immune system that fights viruses and bacteria. You're less likely then to get a severe cold or flu And if you do, it'll last generally less shorter time and not be as virulent. But then you're doing it on a regular basis. So it's sustainable. And therein is lies the difference. So why not enjoy both? Why not enjoy time as many of you used to do? Remember back in the 70s, you'd come up to Fertler Farm for a weekend. We'd play volleyball. We'd go running into the mountains. We'd bike in the mountains. We'd have sing-alongs around the campfire and play in the lake, the small four-acre lake. And we'd have wonderful times just doing things you normally don't do together. And because I was in my young 20s and the audience was in its young 20s, and we just had great times. And it was always a little sad on Sunday afternoon when we had our final meal and everyone, you know, packed up to go back to the city. And I said, go to the garden and whatever's there, harvest it for yourself. And that was always joyful, too, people taking something home. Well, then I started getting people wanting to come back as many as 5 times in the summer, because that's when they went from the stress of the city to the more bucolic and natural, you know, running barefoot and grounding yourself and being in nature and seeing the stars at night. And we forget that. We forget how important it is to put that into our life as a balance, an emotional balance, a spiritual balance. And that's what meditation does, and that's what a vacation does. But don't have to get so stressed from being on a vacation that now you need a vacation from your vacation, because then vacations can also be very stressful depending upon travel and delays. And so just sharing this with you. And another study, so you do both. Get out of the city as often as possible, or get to city parks or green space, or go to the ocean. It doesn't have to be a big deal. And just walk barefoot in the sand. You know, be around people you love being around. Camaraderie is one of the greatest antidotes to illness that you can ever have. And always appreciate the friends you have, because everything in life is a passage of wonderment, excitement, exploration, creativity, or a passage of disease, infirmary, and loss. And the older you get, the more losses you're going to have in your life. And so appreciate every moment and take nothing for granted. From the Environmental Working Group, an article published in the peer-reviewed journal Chemosphere, cleaning products emit hundreds of hazardous chemicals, a new study has found. So here's the answer. Throw away everything that has these artificial chemicals in it, because there's a whole industry now of supplying you with the natural cleaners, the natural detergents, the natural hand sanitizers without the toxic cancer-causing chemicals, the natural shampoos and facial creams. You don't need those chemical items, so don't bring them in. Oh, and one last thing. If you've been listening to this program for any length of time, I'm sure you're taking vitamin A and in different compounds, either as beta-carotene or as retinoic acid, about 10,000 units a day. Well, Stanford University School of Medicine just came up with a study saying retinoic acid derived from the body from vitamin A plays a critical role in suppressing colorectal cancer. Colorectal cancer, yes, it suppresses it in humans and in mice. So, why not put a little vitamin A in your body every day to prevent colorectal cancer? And that's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break because we've got some really interesting stuff coming at you. And always go to GaryNall.com for all the information that I don't have time to get to, essays, commentaries, documentaries, articles, investigative reports. It's all there. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, talking on a telephone, but hopefully you can hear it well. First of all, to Julie Bendel, the program I did the other day with Douglas Murray, the reason I did that program was to have two intelligent, dedicated social activists who are very scholarly. She was one of the founders of the lesbian and the women's movement in Great Britain, and has fought for decades to ensure their rights and freedoms. And along with that, and she's completely different in her politics from the other guest, but they had a very interesting, insightful, and historically accurate look at what has happened with the movement today, especially with now many lesbians and women being attacked by some, not all, of the more radical elements within the trans movement. And so they're pushing back. And so this was an interview without yelling, screaming, demeaning, and cursing and wanting to kill each other. So this is his response. Quote, "Hi, Gary. My husband and I caught up on your shows and heard the recent one featuring an excerpt of a dialogue with Julie Bendel and another guest. That was an extraordinarily interesting dialogue. A riveting reality, helping to clarify an increasing divisive issue. Please feature them as guests on your show. There's so much more that needs to be understood around how we have gotten to this point. They were excellent at contextualizing how we got there." So, and I'm not sure, this is for Norma Ramos. Thank you, Norma, you and your husband for listening. My audience is substantially different than almost any other audience out there, because one of the things that we do is we take issues in depth, not just superficial and not just to latch on to a controversial topic. Instead, I want people to understand the history, the context, and the true meaning of how things evolve. Now, you can agree or disagree with them, but at least they'll be done civilly. They'll be done where you'll have guests on discussing something without being interrupted and without being attacked. I can disagree with them, as I did in a debate recently with a person. She made a few good points, and I commended her and thanked her for those good points. And the issues I disagree with, I took about 5 minutes after giving her almost 20 minutes and challenged her on those. But it was a civil dialogue. It gave you a chance to hear both sides, and you could choose, did any of it make sense? And if so, good. If it didn't, okay, there'll be another program. So that's what you're going to be hearing today and every day, with longer clips, at least one longer clip. And today that longer clip is on Gaddafi. Why? Because if you look at the papers today, the headlines today say that about 21,000 citizens in the country died mainly because of no infrastructure since Gaddafi was killed and Libya fell into anarchy, and all at the behest of Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Susan Rice, and NATO chiefs. There was no legitimacy whatsoever. They lied about everything. Now, I'm not talking about the thousands of tens of thousands of citizens who died and how all the tribes then went into chaos and how our primary motive was to stop him from creating the gold denier, which would have been the currency in Africa instead of the dollar. So it was to protect the hegemonic power of the dollar throughout all of Africa, because at that time, Gaddafi was the most respected leader of the 54 countries in Africa, and he had the African Union working with him. And we couldn't have that. So we took the Paris of Africa and we destroyed it. And the media was responsible for promoting misinformation, out-and-out lies. And so I'm going to push back. But there's going to be a group of African newsmakers who are leading the commentary. I'll only give my introduction to it. But before we get that, and that's our longer piece today, something, I watched a clip and I almost couldn't believe it. I said, this can't be real. But it is real. And it's in California. Where else? And why should you pay attention to this? Why is this important? Because this is about a young 12-year-old. His name is Parker Jensen. Maybe you've heard of the case, maybe not. It's a horrific story where the government of California tried to force a 12-year-old boy to get chemotherapy and radiation immediately against the will of the child or the parents. And even worse, he never even had cancer in the first place. A doctor examined him and without any evidence, no x-rays, No blood test. Just a physical examination said you've got a terminal cancer and you must be put on this experimental chemotherapy immediately. And it scared the parents. So the parents went to oncologists, to hospitals, and they had all these MRIs, CAT scans. They had blood tests, every test you could take. And they all said the same thing. Your kid's healthy. There's no disease in his body. There's no cancer in his body. They had all the prima facie evidence. Here's our CAT scans, here's our MRIs, here's our blood test, here's the oncologist, here's the hospital. The kid is healthy. The state didn't care. The doctor didn't care. So the parents refused to accept the diagnosis and barbaric treatment, wanting to find a second opinion and talk to other doctors first, and they did. So they refused, and before any blood work was done, and no diagnosing doctors and the state said that he had cancer. Then they did the blood work up and said, absolutely, he's clean. Well, the doctor who did the so-called diagnosis said, you've got 2 weeks to live, and wanted to start him on a protocol. So the family said no. Then they wanted to arrest the family, and the father took his family out of the state. And then they created a federal arrest warrant, and they captured the father in Idaho, wanted to put him in jail, wanted to take the son away from the mother and force the son into chemotherapy, which the state and the medical doctors would have done instantly. This is not the first time they did that. If you think that it can't get more perverted than that with medical justice, try New York State. And so Parker and his mom remained on the run for weeks, but eventually proving he had no cancer in the first place, and a judge eventually dismissed the charges. But that didn't stop the state from continuing to go after them. Yes. Yeah. And so that's what happened in the state of California. No justice was delivered. And that Parker kid would have been dead from the chemotherapy from a false diagnosis. This is his story in his words. If you go to PRN.live, you can watch it. Scroll down to archives and scroll down to show notes, and you'll see the videos. Let's go now to that clip.
Utah's Division of Child and Family Services once tried to force the parents of a boy named Parker Jensen to have him undergo chemotherapy for Ewing sarcoma. That polarizing, highly publicized case began more than 5 years ago and has continued since then in the courts.
A federal court yesterday threw out a lawsuit from the parents of Parker Jensen, but the boy's family says their battle is far from over.
I remember the call. The oral surgeon said, hey, you need to come on in and we need to discuss the results. And he sat us down and he says, your son has cancer. And how devastating that was to hear that your 12-year-old has cancer.
When that MRI came out, there was nothing there. They could not find anything in the MRI. And that was our first kind of, I guess, relief. Like, ooh, you know, it's not as bad as they had said it to be. And they did, you know, a bone scan, and that came out negative. And they did a CT scan, and they did chest x-rays and all these things to try to find some cancer. And every one of those tests came out negative. Yet the doctor still kept saying, well, we still expect you to come, you know, Thursday morning to start chemotherapy.
He said I had invisible cancer and that I had to do chemotherapy anyways.
We saw all these efforts to try to just rush and railroad the Jensens and Parker into chemo. Now, that's not normally the way doctors behave. Almost a year of chemo with bad side effects is not something that responsible parents would agree to without being satisfied this is really the right thing.
My dad printed off a huge list of all the chemotherapy drugs. I remember looking through all of them, seeing what they did, side effects of each drug, how many there were.
On a lot of the drugs that were just going to make you a little bit sick, as we were told, we found out 2% of the people die. Just flat out die. Others have major organ damage, tissue damage, brain damage, sterility.
Initially, we thought maybe it's just ego.
The doctor that we weren't supposed to see, but we happened to see, had sponsored a clinical trial for a particular disease, Ewing sarcoma, and it was about ready to be shut down unless they got more 12-year-old white male subjects. The pathologist in the lab was pressured into assigning it Ewing sarcoma. They haven't even taken a blood test yet, and they were forcing chemotherapy, and they reported to the state that he had 2 weeks to live.
If people know that they have that ability, that power, it's just a matter of time before somebody will abuse it.
My parents have always known best, and I can't really ever say that they've ever made a mistake, parenting-wise.
Early on, he looks up at Barbara and I, and he says, "Mom, Dad, I'm not sick." And it just solidified in us that we're right. He is not sick, and we gotta fight this.
Now the case goes to the state court and the federal court of appeals, where the Jensens hope there is a final decision on whether their right to decide what is best for their son was violated.
I didn't want chemotherapy because, looking back on all the tests, like, they were telling me that they were negative. The doctors were saying that they were negative. Everyone's saying that it was clean. I don't want this, that I want them to just leave us alone.
That's when we were threatened that they would take him away, and we had 3 days to get our case together against the state. We finally found the Brzezinski Institute. We were going to take Parker to have this second opinion. When they found out, they issued warrants for our arrest. Little did we know that the fight would be World War Jensen.
Here the fundamental charge was that you were somehow negligent parents. Negligent because the government knows best.
We would get to a point of disparity where you had the feds looking for you, you had the local police, you had the state police. We're basically in exile because we have these warrants out for us.
One night, Darren said, "If I go to jail, you are not to bring Parker back. You are not to turn him in." And Darren was charged with kidnapping his own son, and because they were neglecting to treat him.
For several weeks, my family was on the lam. I was in jail. I mean, I'm willing to be responsible if I make a wrong decision. That's what parents are for.
Darren and Barbara Jensen charged with kidnapping and medical neglect because they refused chemotherapy for their son.
What really kills me is at the end they said that we didn't win, we just didn't lose either.
Yeah, it was our non-loss.
Mind you, any mindless idiocy can occur in California. After all, they just passed a law, it's now the law in California, that if you're a 4-year-old kid, a 3-year-old kid, and you believe that your biological sex is not determined by what you were born with, but rather what you feel like, and you've been groomed by school teachers, all without the consent or knowledge of your parents, and the parents want you not to be transitioned, the state now will take the child away from the parents, accuse the parents of neglect and abuse, and put the child into a position where it can get that kind of therapy. Wow. Can they do anything more corrupt and evil in the state of California? They probably still have more to go. And that's one of the reasons a lot of people are leaving, not just the high taxes and the corrupt government, but just the insanity of their legislative process. And that's Gavin Newsom, too. Remember that when he gets to be, when Joe Biden is set aside, which is inevitable. I like your thoughts. What if it was your kid? It was completely healthy and had proof of it, absolute irrefutable proof from 20 doctors and medical, and yet the state says, nope, we don't care what that they say. Our doctor says you need treatment. How would you feel? What would you do? Now let's go to, before we go to Libya, I want you to hear a senator, U.S. Senator Eric Brakey. I'd never heard him before. He finally found his voice, and so he had a chance to speak out about NATO and funding the U.S. war machine, proxy war in Ukraine. Listen to what he has to say and see if you agree or disagree with him. See if he says something that doesn't make sense or is inaccurate. Show me, call in and tell me where he's made a mistake, where he's in error. And if he hasn't been in error, and if what he's saying is factually true, then why has the entirety of the U.S. Congress, Democrat and Republican alike, voted unanimously to keep shoveling money into the most corrupt regime on the planet, where we already have whistleblowers, including the former president's bagman, saying that all the money that Americans give is captured by the top brass, including Zelensky, and we know it, and we won't. We will continue doing it. Wow! Here's what he has to say.
Thank you, Madam President. I rise in opposition to this resolution in the strongest terms possible as a piece of war propaganda that I will not have my name or my vote attached to. This resolution on the war in Ukraine is riddled with half-truths, historical omissions, and dangerous conclusions that urge our nation down the path towards a potential global nuclear war, the likes of which no one alive or dead on this earth has ever seen, and one that humanity will never experience twice. Rather than urging peace talks to bring an end to this dangerous border dispute halfway across the world, this resolution presents a simplistic narrative with no grounding in the realities of foreign policy or the history of Eastern Europe since the end of the Cold War in order to justify a continued blank check, now over $100 billion, much of it totally unaccounted for, from the pockets of U.S. taxpayers to the Ukrainian government in an undeclared proxy war with no exit strategy and in which continued escalation endangers the entire world. Passing this resolution, adding the voice of the main Senate to this fool's errand, would be grossly irresponsible. I will readily admit that when I was a young man, I was fooled once by war propaganda. But to quote the president who fooled me, "Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, you aren't going to fool me twice." After learning the lessons of the disastrous Middle East wars, I resolved to follow the advice of another president, Dwight D. Eisenhower, who served as Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces during World War II. In his farewell address to Congress, he told America to beware the military-industrial complex. It is also worth remembering the words of Major General Smedley Butler, a very decorated Marine and veteran of World War I, who simply put it, "War is a racket." So whenever the bipartisan war machine, the Uniparty in Washington, urges our country into foreign wars, it is the responsibility of all citizens, especially lawmakers and bodies like these, to maintain cool heads and ask basic questions. So let's begin with a basic question about one of the claims in this resolution, seemingly parroting a repeated line in the corporate press, which is funded with advertising dollars from weapons manufacturers, that the Russian invasion in Ukraine was unprovoked. Madam President, there are many justifiable adjectives to describe this war: bloody, vicious, murderous, tyrannical, evil, illegal. I would accept any of these, but I will not sign my name to a lie. The claim this invasion was unprovoked can only be uttered sincerely if history began the day Russian troops crossed the border. In truth, there's been a long line of provocations, many made by Washington officials, supposedly accountable to the American people, bringing us to this crisis point. To be clear, provocation does not justify an action. A man may violently stab another who shoved him first. That stabbing would be wrong, just as this invasion is wrong. But it would also be false to say it was unprovoked. This word is used to absolve Washington war hawks of the numerous acts of incompetence and malevolence in the decades of buildup to this conflict since the fall of the Berlin Wall. And if we do not acknowledge the actions of our own foreign policy elites in our own federal government that have contributed to this war, then we have no hope in prescribing a proper course of action to bring about a peaceful resolution. Throughout the Cold War, the number one American foreign policy goal with regards to the Soviet Union was to keep nuclear weapons at bay. When the Cold War ended and the Soviet government dissolved, the nuclear arsenals remained, and so did the American interest in avoiding conflict that could bring about the end of the world as we know it. That's why there were agreements in those early days of the new era that Russia would not contest the reunification of Germany and its admittance into NATO. In exchange, American officials committed in writing that NATO would not extend, quote, 1 inch east beyond the German border. That agreement was promptly violated in the 1990s under President Clinton against the explicit warnings of American foreign policy experts who cautioned Russia would fear and react to these violations as nakedly hostile attempts to surround them militarily. And every American president since, Republicans and Democrats both, this is a bipartisan problem, has continued this manifest destiny policy of eastward NATO expansion towards the Russian border, disregarding the consistent warnings from both U.S. foreign policy realists and repeated red lines from the Russians that this is viewed as an existential threat to their national security. Some say NATO is a defensive alliance, so what does Russia have to worry about? I would ask them to tell that to Muammar Gaddafi, the former leader of Libya. His government invaded no other nation, and yet his life ended as he was sodomized to death in the streets after a NATO-led regime change war in his country. Is that what a defensive military alliance does? And for what purpose? Certainly no humanitarian outcome. The people of Libya now find themselves subject to open-air slave markets today in the 21st century. There is no excuse for invading a sovereign country. This is the principle readily proclaimed in this present foreign crisis, and one with which I heartily agree. But it is odd to hear this principle now often repeated in Washington by the very war hawks who I've watched since I was 12 years old, lying the American people into wars with invented pretexts to justify the invasion and occupation of sovereign Middle East countries for decades on end, paid for with the blood of our soldiers and the treasure of our taxpayers. And I wonder, Madam President, how we would feel as Americans if our roles were reversed. For a moment, I would ask this chamber to imagine a mirror reality, one in which the Russians won the Cold War and the Warsaw Pact was inducting Canada into its membership, putting their military on our border just north of Aroostook County. Would we shrug our shoulders and rest assured that the Warsaw Pact is only a defensive military alliance? Would we tell ourselves there was nothing to worry about after watching the Soviet Union as the world's last empire and superpower left standing spend the last two decades on regime change wars across the Middle East with death tolls nearing 1 million? As their military alliance snaked its way through Central America toward our southern border, with the KGB running intelligence operations to manipulate election outcomes and overthrow uncooperative leaders, would we not demand our leaders do something to protect our country from the threat encircling us? And if our economy and our military were a shadow of their former glory, and all we had left was a nuclear arsenal to tell Russia not to mess with us, how far would America be pushed before twitchy fingers were on the button? In truth, we don't have to imagine too hard how our country would respond to a Russian military threat on our border, because we know how America did respond during the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy considered Russian missiles off our coast a provocation, and he took action to secure our country, just as any national leader responsible to their people would when an antagonistic military force is approaching their border. Only fools would put a country with a nuclear arsenal in that position, cornered, fearful, and desperate, and then reject all offers to negotiate. Thankfully, Kennedy used diplomacy to defuse the danger of that situation, a skill our leaders in Washington today seem unwilling or unable to exercise. Both Presidents Kennedy and Reagan, adamant Cold Warriors both, none would be accused of being friends to the Russians, always maintained open communication with the leaders of Russia to avoid escalation into nuclear conflict. Instead, our present-day leaders refused diplomacy and pushed the war forward to the last Ukrainian standing, not for the benefit of the people of Ukraine, but to bleed the Russians dry, as in Afghanistan throughout the 1980s. This posture isn't for the Ukrainian people. This isn't for the American people. This is for the empire that now stands in the place of our once proud republic on a mountain of corpses to maintain global hegemony. That's why in 2014, then Vice President Joe Biden oversaw the overthrow of the democratically elected president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych. His crime was not signing a trade deal with the European Union. In actuality, he wanted to sign two trade deals with both Russia and the West. But when the EU agreement suddenly prohibited any economic agreement with Russia, Yanukovych says he felt like a bride who showed up for a wedding only to discover a never-before-discussed prenuptial agreement, and he just wasn't in the mood anymore. For that, he was regime-changed. And if you doubt Washington, D.C. had anything to do with it, I have a bridge to sell you in Libya. Thanks to leaked phone calls, we know for a fact that the current Undersecretary of State, Victoria Nuland, personally handpicked the leaders of the new government to replace Yanukovych. You can hear the phone call in her own voice as she speaks with the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine about who is in and who is out in the new Ukrainian regime to make the whole thing stick. Is this what democracy looks like? I don't think so. And after the coup, the new government, urged on by local neo-Nazi groups like the Azov Battalion, and when I say neo-Nazi groups, I don't mean in the parlance that that's often thrown around today. I mean actual Adolf Hitler-loving neo-Nazis who welcomed the Hitler the German invasion during World War II. They urged the government and succeeded in banning the speaking of Russian and launching an ethnic cleansing campaign in the eastern regions of Ukraine. Russia responded, yes, by annexing the Crimean Peninsula to maintain control of the Sevastopol naval base, Russia's only warm water port with access to the Black Sea, which is a sort of Russian Alamo after many died defending it against German invasion in World War II. Whatever we think of that, it is of such strategic and nationalistic importance to the Russians, we better be prepared for nuclear war if we want them to give that up, because they're not going to give that up. But at the same time, he rejected petitions from ethnically Russian people in the Donbass region of eastern Ukraine, now at the center of the war, who wanted to secede and join Russia. But over the next 8 years, a civil war raged in these separatist regions. Our own government funneled weapons into the conflict. In 2016, I represented Maine on the National Platform Committee of my political party, along with our colleague, Senator Garin of Penobscot County. At the time, I was shocked to read calls for sending these weapons into this civil war halfway across the world. That's why I opposed that language and fought to strike it from the document, warning that these policies could escalate into a nuclear conflict. And 7 years later, here we are, living under the shadow of it all. These are only some of the most significant provocations. NATO expansion, deposing a democratically elected government, funneling weapons into a civil war on Russia's border. I haven't even mentioned the torn-up nuclear treaties and the years of domestic anti-Russian propaganda pushed onto the American people through an unholy alliance between U.S. intelligence agencies and the corporate press. Do you all remember that report that Vladimir Putin was putting bounties on U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan? That story was as false as the reports of Iraqi soldiers ripping Kuwaiti babies from incubators in the lead-up to Desert Storm. Pure war propaganda. It was completely debunked. This disinformation was planted in the media by, quote, anonymous intelligence officials in the lead up to a major U.S. election. But if you ever read a retraction, you were lucky to find it on page 36 after months of front page coverage. That's how war propaganda works with the war machine. Lie, rinse, repeat, and never apologize. And let me preempt the accusations that I know will be coming likely outside this chamber, because I would never suggest that anyone in this chamber would make such accusations. But let me preempt it by stating clearly that Vladimir Putin, like so many governmental leaders across the world, is a tyrant. As a lover of liberty, he could be strung up like Saddam Hussein, and I wouldn't shed a tear. There's plenty of blood on his hands, and I'm sure that the day he meets his maker, there will be a lot to account for. So it is not for the sake of any despot that I oppose this resolution, but for love of our country and the wisdom of early leaders like George Washington and John Quincy Adams, who warned our country against entangling alliances, being drawn into European power struggles, and going abroad in search of monsters to destroy. And for the love of all the people caught up in this war, for the conscripted and enslaved men of Ukraine and Russia pitted against each other to the death for the benefit of oligarchs, for the many dead and displaced civilians, for those starving across the world from the consequences of a war in the Ukrainian breadbasket, for those in Europe, America, and here in Maine, freezing this winter due to natural gas shortages, and for everyone alive today and generations yet unborn who face the very real threat of nuclear annihilation, we must demand immediate diplomacy to end this war. Yet we see no diplomacy from Washington. In the rattling of their sabers for war with Russia, the Uniparty claims it is love of democracy and hatred of tyrants that drives them. So where are these affections as they partner with Saudi princes to genocide the people of Yemen? What makes the Yemeni people less worthy of our concern? Is their skin the wrong color? Are their lives of less value because they live in the wrong part of the world? Or is Washington simply so addicted to Saudi oil and the petrodollar that props up our paper currency that the deaths of 250,000 people is worth the cost? Madam President, it seems George Orwell predicted the state we find ourselves in. If you listen to the talking heads on the television screens, it would seem we've always been at war with Eurasia. But if you go searching down the memory hole for scraps of what was and possibilities of what could have been, you will find stories about the days when George W. Bush and Vladimir Putin toured Texas high schools together after the Russian president's call of support following the 9/11 Twin Tower attacks. You will find stories about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton hitting a reset button on U.S.-Russian relations for a new era of peace. So when did all this change? It is certainly not just that Vladimir Putin is a tyrant. As I've established, our leaders in Washington are fond of many tyrants around the world. The public pivot seems to have taken place when Russia stood opposed to the invasions of Iraq, Libya, and Syria, all grossly unconstitutional wars by our own American standards and waged for no clear American purpose beyond the profits of that institution Eisenhower warned us of. When Russia blocked the dreams of regime change in Syria, this appears to have been the last straw, and we've seen nothing but provocation and heard only drumbeats for war ever since. Madam President, the stakes on this matter are higher than any war in my admittedly short life of 34 years. Unlike Iraq, the nuclear weapons are not the imagined fantasies of war profiteers. The arsenals are real. Continued escalation is toying with nuclear fire, which could set the world ablaze. Today, we are fortunate to be alive to be able to look back at Iraq and admit mistakes were made. But 20 years from now, will we be so able under the clouds of nuclear winter? Even should the nukes stay put, and God help us, I hope so, nothing else good can be had from this war. The Ukrainian people die while peace talks should be taking place. America's strategic position in the world is weakened as China and Russia have formed an alliance against us. Our fair-weather friends in Saudi Arabia entertain breaking the petrodollar, threatening the U.S. dollar's status as the global reserve currency and unleashing hyperinflation on our country. Rising economic powers, including India, refuse to fall in line with U.S. sanctions, as it turns out that after decades of invading foreign countries in the Middle East, few nations outside Europe recognize America's moral authority anymore on the question of invading foreign countries. And Madam President, if this resolution was truly in the interest of peace, I will tell you what it would say. It would not call for continued conditionless spending and racking up trillions of dollars more in debt on the American people in order to draw out a war that endangers the whole world. This resolution would demand that that Secretary of State Antony Blinken go to Geneva and sit down for peace talks with both Russian and Ukrainian leaders to resolve this border dispute, broker a peace, end the war, end the famine, end the energy crisis, and take the very real threat of nuclear annihilation off the table. That is what this body should be calling for. Peace, not war. I invite every member of this body to join me in voting for peace by rejecting this resolution. Thank you very much for your time and your consideration.
Now let's go to Gaddafi. First and foremost, we're going to play the clip. It's not long, but I want you to hear it. And then I'll give you my commentary with the time I have remaining of life under Gaddafi. But I'm going to post my notes of my commentary in case I don't have time to share all of it with you. But what we did in Libya was genocide. And there was no legitimate reason. And we did it anyhow. So here are African journalists, who are never invited in America to give this, telling the truth. And so this is a shout out to Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, Susan Rice, and all the other people who are responsible for taking down a country and lying to the American public and all the media responsible for it.
Why did the U.S. invade Libya, one of the greatest economies and most powerful countries in Africa? Why did the U.S. kill Muammar Gaddafi, the head of Libya and the greatest leader of Africa? Some say it was to protect Libyans from its so-called barbaric leader, while others say it was due to its vast oil reserves. No doubt the U.S. has a history of greed and invasions due to this greed. Wherever there was gold and oil, the U.S. troops invaded with the excuse of saving civilians. On a lighter note, it's also said that if the U.S. comes to know that heaven is full of gold and oil, its president will order its troops to go to churches and pray harder. However, the reason behind invading Libya was different. What was it? Well, the leaked emails of then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton reveal that the UD did it because Gaddafi was preparing to launch the gold dinar, a currency backed by gold, having the power to replace the United States dollar. Welcome to a new episode of Black Culture Diary, a channel where we talk about less-known and hidden black history, culture, arts, and lost civilization. We scrutinize history here to bring the black culture back on the surface again. In this episode, we will debunk how the U.S. dissolved Muammar Gaddafi's plan of gold dinar. Let's get started. Muammar Gaddafi is the man who gave the concept to unite Africa and form the United States of Africa. He is the man who wanted to give an international gold currency called gold dinar, replacing the United States dollar. That's why he threatened the U.S. and its centuries-long hegemony over the world. However, the United States of America could not kill Gaddafi directly. Otherwise, it would have looked evil. People would have known that America wanted Libya's oil and gold and wanted to dissolve the grand concept of the gold dinar. Hence, it did grand propaganda against Muammar Gaddafi and portrayed him as a barbaric ruler, threatening the Libyans and the entire world. But this was not so easy for the U.S. The U.S. and its allies were pivotal in creating a negative perception of Muammar Gaddafi among the Libyan population and the international community. They employed various tactics to accomplish this goal. To begin with, the U.S. government and media depicted Gaddafi as a ruthless dictator who employed violence and repression to hold on to power. They highlighted his human rights violations, including torture, extrajudicial killings, and detention without trial. This portrayal aimed to paint Gaddafi as a leader who was not only oppressive, but also posed a threat to his own people. But none of this was ever proved, and there was no evidence. Furthermore, the U.S. and its allies supported the Libyan opposition groups against Gaddafi's regime. They provided them with both financial and military assistance, contributing to the narrative that Gaddafi was facing a popular uprising. The media widely reported this narrative, and it justified NATO's military intervention. The U.S. and its allies also imposed economic sanctions on Libya and sought to isolate Gaddafi diplomatically. They expelled Libyan diplomats from their countries, urged other nations to impose economic sanctions, and prevented Gaddafi from traveling overseas. These actions were intended to isolate Gaddafi and make him appear as a global outcast. Finally, the U.S. and its allies disseminated propaganda to discredit Gaddafi further. They spread unfounded rumors and false information, such as accusations that he had committed genocide or supported terrorism. This information was frequently presented as fact without any supporting evidence, and it helped shape a negative image of Gaddafi in many people's minds. These tactics created a negative image of Gaddafi among the Libyan people and the international community. This negative perception and support for the opposition and NATO's eventual military intervention significantly contributed to Gaddafi's downfall. Before we continue further, tell us, are you enjoying the video? If yes, please like and share the video and subscribe to our channel to watch more videos on Black culture, history, civilization, and identity. Let's continue now. However, at this point, you might ask why America would do all this just to avoid gold dinar. If that's the case, you should understand how gold dinar was a threat to the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar has a dominant role in the global economy, providing America with unprecedented economic power. International currency transactions, foreign exchange reserves, and world debt rely heavily on the dollar. As a result, the United States significantly influences any country that imports or exports goods and services. In 2016, the publication of Clinton's emails revealed another agenda behind the Libyan war. The primary objective was to prevent the demise of the American dollar by avoiding the creation of an independent hard currency in Africa. The new currency would have freed the continent from its economic dependence and posed a significant threat to the dollar and the euro. Gaddafi urged African and Muslim countries to unite and create a new currency backed by gold in the months following the military intervention in 2011. This new currency would have ensured that countries sell their oil and other natural resources in return for gold rather than U.S. dollars. This idea would have altered the global economic balance, with countries' wealth dependent on the amount of gold they possessed, not the amount of U.S. dollars they traded or held. In Western economies, banks are the main source of money creation, not governments. Originally, all currency reserves worldwide were backed by gold. However, in 1933, President Franklin Roosevelt replaced domestic gold with central bank-created reserves. Although gold remained the reserve currency for other countries until 1944, that year saw the establishment of the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. Their goal was to globally unify the bank-created money system, with 44 countries agreeing that the US dollar would become the world currency, created privately as debt with interest. This system required a steady stream of debtors, and over the next half century, most developing countries, primarily in Africa, became indebted to the IMF. The reason is this new order was structurally developed for exploitation. The loans came with several strings attached, such as structural adjustment programs that hindered economic growth. Under the agreement, the US dollar was pegged to gold, while other global currencies were pegged to the US dollar. However, in the 1970s, when the US could no longer maintain the dollar's gold backing, it made a swift deal with OPEC to use oil to back the currency, creating the petrodollar. In 1971, President Richard Nixon announced that the dollar would no longer be exchangeable for gold, a move intended to secure US dominance and stimulate economic growth for the superpower. However, any country purchasing oil from OPEC would have to exchange its currency into US dollars before the sale was complete. Additionally, oil and other natural resources were priced in US currency, not in the currency of their country of origin. As a result, if the US dollar loses value, the natural resources also lose value. This system provided two immediate benefits to the US. It increased global demand for US dollars and allowed the US to purchase oil and other resources with a currency it could print at will. The global financial system was created and sustained not purely by economics, but by politics, specifically through the Saudi Arabia deal that replaced gold as the world reserve currency and ultimate store of value. The US dollar took that place, transferring the ultimate store of value from gold to the US dollar. Now let's know how the US involved the West and NATO in killing Muammar Gaddafi. In 2009, President Muhammad Gaddafi seized control of the African Union, an organization he co-founded and had long wanted to reform to enhance his pan-African reputation. The West was unsure how Gaddafi would wield his position as head of the African Union. During the early 2000s, Gaddafi sought to cultivate better relations with Western nations and corporations by offering to open up vital sectors of the Libyan economy to foreign investment. However, the 2003 invasion of Iraq and Gaddafi's public warning at an Arab League summit that America could come after him next, akin to Saddam Hussein, left Western leaders skeptical of his true intentions. Gaddafi championed the age-old aspiration of transforming Africa into a massive unified state that could exert significant global influence. He frequently advocated for immediate unity and establishing a singular currency, army, and passport across the continent. Yet the idea of a gold-backed single currency did not appeal to the West, who sought to safeguard their interests. In 2011, then-French President Nicolas Sarkozy reportedly deemed Gaddafi a threat to global financial security. One of the emails uncovered from Hillary Clinton's private email server revealed that the Libyan government possessed 143 tons of gold and a similar amount of silver, intended to be used to create a pan-African currency based on the Libyan gold dinar. This initiative aimed to offer French-printed currency using African countries an alternative, which influenced Sarkozy's decision to support the Libyan invasion. France's motives were driven by a desire to increase its share of Libya's oil production, strengthen its presence in North Africa, enhance Sarkozy's political situation domestically, empower the French military, and address apprehensions regarding Gaddafi's long-term plan to displace France as the dominant force in Francophone Africa. Notably, humanitarian concerns were absent from these objectives. Ultimately, the invasion of Libya was about money, power, and oil, as well as preserving France's stronghold on Francophone Africa. Gaddafi's actions significantly threatened those in power, as he went beyond merely selling oil in a different currency. He was meticulously planning the Pan-African gold currency, set to launch in 2023, which would have promoted African self-reliance and potentially disrupted the global financial system. By organizing an African monetary coup and demonstrating the possibility of achieving financial independence, Gaddafi became a major player in the world of finance. Listen to his confidence in his power and what he could achieve. The West could see what Gaddafi was capable of. The Great Man-Made River was one of Gaddafi's most ambitious infrastructure projects, which transformed arid regions of Libya into thriving agricultural areas. The $33 billion project was fully funded by Libya's state-owned bank, interest-free, and with zero foreign debt. Despite being recognized as the largest irrigation system in the world, Western media was reluctant to share news on the project. NATO forces effectively destroyed the Great Man-Made River project when they bombed the pipeline and the factory producing the pipes necessary to repair it. Hence, the answer to why the West assassinated Gaddafi is clear: money and oil and the security of the global financial system. Although some people in NATO countries may be motivated by humanitarian concerns, governments typically do not intervene in other nations solely to benefit humanity. Wars are often sold as acts of philanthropy, but generosity is rarely the primary motive for government intervention. After knowing all this, what do you think is why Muammar Gaddafi was killed? Was it because of the gold dinar and the plans of the United States of Africa that Muammar Gaddafi was proposing? Or was there any other reason we still don't know? Let us know your opinion on what would have happened if Muammar Gaddafi had been alive today. Do you want to watch more videos like this one? If yes, subscribe to our channel and press the bell icon next to it. We have decided to bring videos on something nobody talks about: the black culture, civilization, history, and evidence about how glorious blacks have been.
Unfortunately, I will wait to our next program to present my commentary on why, had Africa followed Gaddafi, there would be none of the rule of France and the United States or influence of those who are there to exploit its resources and impoverish its citizens. But that will be on our next program because we're out of time. Thank you all for listening and watching today, and I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day, everyone.